Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Stop me if you've heard this one before. It's a story that ran on 60 Minutes late last year, and it went like this. There's a composer studying at New York's renowned Juilliard School who some say is the greatest talent to come along in 200 years. He's written 5 full-length symphonies, and he's only 12 years old. His teacher calls him a prodigy at the level of the greatest prodigies in history, Mozart and Mendelssohn, and the story goes on and on. Well, there is a chance that the young man will be one of the great talents of all time, but there's a greater chance that this child prodigy will crash, unable to meet such superlative descriptions and expectations. Today, we're going to talk with people who have experienced and studied the phenomenon of the child prodigy, and we'd like to have you along as well. Here's the key question. What happens when the child prodigy is no longer a child? I mean, have we figured out how to nurture and coach children like this? Is it dangerous to spend too much time concentrating on one skill of one child, regardless of how magnificent that might be? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm starting today with Ellen Winner. She's a professor of psychology at Boston College and a specialist in cognitive development, author of a book called Gifted Children, Myths and Realities. Ellen, nice to have you back in the studio here.
Nice to be here.
I'm thinking about this story of the 12-year-old composer. Jay Greenberg is his name. Do you know?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sure you track these things more carefully than I do. The stories are always written with such superlatives, and of course, you know, he's just the latest to get this kind of attention. Why is it that we're so fascinated by these people?
Well, we are clearly absolutely fascinated by child prodigies, and that's because child prodigies are like adults. They are children who are performing as adults in some domain. They're almost like freaks. They're unbelievable, some of their skills. We have children who can read by age 2 or 3, children who start to talk by age 6 months. And these children seem to be teaching themselves. So it's fascinating and difficult to understand.
We usually hear about them in the field of music, but we also get them in a bunch of other fields, math, for example. Do we include athletic prodigies in this same area? Does that fit?
I would. I think Tiger Woods was a golf prodigy. There's another golf prodigy now who's about 14. She was a prodigy from very early on in golf. There's a soccer prodigy now I just saw on television on a CBS show.
The next Pele is the one that I've seen that as well.
But I would make a distinction. I think that prodigies in athletics, what they're doing as children is closer to what they need to do as adults to stay great. But if you go into a domain such as math, what prodigies in math are doing is quite different from what an adult mathematician needs to do. So I think the transition is much more difficult, and they're probably less likely to make
it. It's a great place to try and move from childhood into adulthood. The athletes that we talk about seem to make that kind of transition from being a 10-year-old golf pro to being a 30-year-old golf pro. There may be some psychological baggage along the way. I know we've seen that with athletes. Why is it harder for someone who's in music or in academics to make that same kind of transition from being a star mathematician at age 4 to a star mathematician at age 40?
Well, I would make a distinction between a prodigy and an adult creator. A prodigy is a child who masters a domain that's already been created, that's already been invented. And an adult creator is somebody who has to do something new. So a child prodigy in math is mastering math that's already been done, much like a good computer. But to become a great mathematician, that child has to become an adult who can ask new questions, figure out new problems to solve, or solve problems that have never been solved before.
Now, there are, I think, exceptions to this. I mean, there are, perhaps not in math, but in music. If we're talking about 5-year-olds or 10-year-olds who are composing music, then even at the prodigy stage, they're creators, are they not?
Yeah, I would make a distinction between performing music, which is really recreating it, and composing music. But nonetheless, child composers, and there are many fewer child composers than child performers, but child composers are not necessarily doing what I call big C creativity, which means transforming a domain. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that it takes at least 10 years of mastering a domain before you can do something really creative and transform it. So a child may be a composing prodigy, but that doesn't mean that the compositions that child creates are ones which change the domain.
And is that then the big valley that these prodigies have to cross from being amazing and remarkable at age 8 to then being creative as an adult?
Yes. I mean, every child prodigy eventually becomes an ex-prodigy. And if that prodigy is going to go from being an ex-prodigy to an adult creator, they really have to remake themselves. They have to be innovative. They have to have a desire to shake things up and do something revolutionary. And that's a very different skill from mastering a domain that's already out there.
Let's bring Jean Bamberger into the conversation. Jean is a retired professor of music at MIT, joining us on the phone from Berkeley, California. Hi, Jean.
Good morning.
And you were a child prodigy yourself, quite a pianist. At what age now?
Well, I guess I began playing in public when I was about 8.
And when you listen to Ellen talking about the transition from being brilliant and highly acclaimed at age 8 in the public eye to whatever comes after that, does that sound like what you went through as well?
Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing is that a lot of kids who are playing up a storm, so to speak, when they're little, in mid-adolescence, many of them really fall apart, not necessarily psychologically, although that can happen too, but they really they just can't play the way they played before, and it's very disturbing.
And so how do you, well, you clearly made it across that gap and went on to a distinguished career teaching music, but do you know what it was that allowed you to get from childhood to adulthood, Jean, without that kind of, I don't know, what do you call it, a midlife crisis for a child prodigy?
Well, I think what happened, my hunch, after watching little violinists, 8-9-year-old violinists at the Longy School there, my hunch is that what happens is that the little kids they're quite phenomenal at imitating. They can listen to somebody else play and just play it back. They can listen to their teacher tell them what to do, and they can just do it. But when they get a little older, they begin asking themselves, why am I doing it this way instead of that way? What's going on in the music that I should be paying attention to? And I don't think that we give kids the opportunity to prepare for those questions and those reflections that come with adolescence, sort of across the board, but also with respect to their performance.
The use of the word imitator, Ellen, that's strikes me as a good way of describing what you're getting at, too. Yeah?
I think it's very much like what I'm saying when I'm saying that prodigies master a domain that's already given to them. They're not creating it.
It's a little more specific and detailed with performers because, you know, if the teachers, certainly my teachers initially, would say, you have to play those few notes a little faster, or a little louder, or put an accent here, or wiggle that finger differently. But they would never talk about why. And they would never talk about, or rarely talk about, what was going on in the music itself that would motivate doing this or that.
And Jean, would you ever ask why? Why do I have to do it that way?
Or that was what, that was the great moment of revelation or disaster, I'm not sure which, when my teacher, Arthur Schnabel, at the very first lesson, he said to me in very friendly way, not aggressively or putting down, he said, well, why did you play that that way? Nobody had ever asked me that question before. And I had no idea how to even think about it. And that was a life-changing experience.
One that had you actually stepping away from music for a period of time?
Well, it had me struggling with my own performing, and that was what led me to start thinking about what is this piece of music and what has it got to do with the way I play it, and how can I put those two things together? And then I began studying music instead of studying the piano. In fact, Schnabel used to say, I don't teach the piano. Does the carpenter teach the hammer?
Ellen Winter, when we try to figure out how we define a prodigy, are there some simple tests here? Because I know there's parents listening along going, well, my daughter's particularly gifted. Is she a prodigy or a potential prodigy? What's the definition? Is there one that works?
Well, usually people talk about prodigies as being children who perform like adults in a particular domain. I think there are a few characteristics that we could talk about. The first and most obvious one is that, as I've just said, because they're like little adults, they're right. Precocious. They do things at the wrong ages. They do things way earlier than other kids. But I think another characteristic that's extremely important is what I call a rage to master. And what I mean by that is a passion. These are kids who are incredibly driven. You really can't...
By themselves or by their parents?
Well, that's the thing. People think it's the parents pushing.
Yeah.
But the parents are often there, standing by and enabling and even pushing some. But
right.
These kids are first and foremost pushing themselves. And
well,
the parents are running along trying to catch up.
Any other things that we need for our checklist?
It's also, I also talk about them as marching to their own drummer. And what I mean by that is they're not just faster, they're different. They're often solving problems in new ways. I don't mean in big C creative ways, transforming the domain, but they're doing things and they're solving problems unlike other kids. And they're learning unlike other kids because they're teaching themselves. They don't need an adult scaffolding them.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation that's getting us a little closer to understanding the child prodigy and that particularly difficult moment when the child is no longer a child but still has some of the skills for which the boy or the girl was recognized, either as a musician or a mathematician or a football player. What is it that we need to understand about child prodigies to figure out how they make that kind of shift? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Is it dangerous to spend too much time fascinated by that one skill of that one child as we sort of embrace the idea of the child prodigy? Certainly, if we judge by the interest of the news media and the way these poor kids draw the attention of reporters, we may in fact be a part of making their lives particularly difficult when they make that switch to being grown-ups. We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ellen Winter's here with me in the studio. She is a senior research associate at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and a professor of psychology at Boston College who specializes in cognitive development. Jean Bamberger is with us. She's a retired music professor from MIT, was herself a child prodigy, and has written on that. Such things as cognitive issues and the development of the musically gifted children, conceptions of giftedness. Jean, just to sort of complete the thought that we had started prior to the break on this way that we need to try and define the prodigy. You listen to Ellen's list. Would you add anything to that?
Well, I would tend to disagree with her about the role of parents, I think.
Okay.
In my experience in watching these kids, it's true that they appear to be self-motivating and self-driven, but the role of the parent, there's always an adult behind every one of these kids, and I think the adult is satisfying needs often as much as the kids are, and that becomes a very tangled situation often.
Even a two-year-old who picks up a violin, a three-year-old, you're saying there's always an adult somewhere in the background there?
First of all, the kid has to have a violin to pick up. and that means that there was an adult who provided that instrument. And I think that the whole culture situation is very, very important. That is, if the child is growing up in a culture where violin playing has a value, that's going to make a big difference as compared with the kid who grows up in a culture where violin playing doesn't even exist. So I think it's a much bigger picture than one individual becoming obsessed with being whatever kind of a performer they become.
Ellen, what do you think?
Well, I agree that there's always an adult behind these children enabling. But what I think is important to stress is that these children have a rage to master. They are internally driven. You can't take a normal child and make that child have a rage to master math or chess or drawing or music. You just can't. Some of these children practice or work at their domain for hours a day and love it. They get flow out of it. And you can't take a normal child and make that child into a prodigy.
Even if we were talking about a 3 or a 4-year-old whose one main motivating drive might be to please the parent who's sort of standing in the next room looking around the corner going, oh, isn't that wonderful?
Well, you could probably make a very compliant child work hard, but you can't give them this drive that comes internally. I mean, if you look at the kinds of kids who are math prodigies, for instance, some of these kids are going off and reading math books to try to understand
right.
math. That kind of curiosity and drive, you can't force a child to have.
Let's bring Rob Capello in on the conversation now. Our Connection listeners know Rob for his What Makes It Great study of music. He's been a guest on this program a number of times before. Rob's a composer and a conductor and a commentator. And Rob, dare I say, almost a child prodigy?
Well, blessedly, not completely.
Okay, but when did you first perch on the piano bench? Age 3, 4, 5, what?
Yeah, I started piano at 4 just so I could get my mother to stop.
Did it work?
It actually did. She was playing. I couldn't bear it. And once I started to play, she stopped. So it was really quite a successful 4-year-old foray.
Would you look back at your own childhood for us and say that, you know, that you could have been a child prodigy if one of your parents had decided to push and push and push you on the piano?
Well, I would say part one is true, part two, no. In other words, I think that I could have focused. One of the things that I look back now, and I'm really happy, is that I was interested in everything. I played piano at 4, I played violin at 6, I played guitar, I played flute, I played in rock bands, I played jazz, I played Beethoven. I just sort of went wherever my curiosity went, and the idea, even at the age of 5, of taking one of those skills and having that be the pinhole through which I viewed the world was just inconceivable to me. And so I think that I was very fortunate to not focus on any one of those and have the wide experience of all of them. I was just as interested in, you know, being a national tennis player at that time as I was playing jazz piano. But I think that I very healthily, in retrospect, just went wherever my interests lay.
And I don't think
they could have forced me.
Okay, I was just going to ask, what was your parents' role in that whole process? Was it just do whatever you want, just don't break a window?
It was the first battlefield of many in my childhood, which was that my mother was a great music lover. You know, she went to all these concerts here, so she was extremely supportive, particularly of the classical side, although she did drive me to all the rock band rehearsals. But my father thought it was a dangerous thing. He thought one instrument was plenty, 2 was too many, 3 was utterly unreasonable, and in fact, one of the reasons I did so much sports was that was what allowed me to do this. He thought, well, okay, at least if he's doing some sports, he might someday approach normalcy. And so that was actually a ticket to allow me to take another instrument.
All right, Connection listeners, pull up your chair. We're trying to get a little bit closer to an understanding of the child prodigy. We'd like your help. We're at 1-800-423-8255 to North Attleboro, Massachusetts. Tom's on the line. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, my experience is mostly with athletic prodigies. And
what sport, Tom?
I'm sorry?
What sport?
Skiing.
Okay.
Snow skiing. It could be that we're talking about degrees of prodiginess. I'm not sure. But in many cases that I can think of, that gift ultimately became a liability in that there comes a point, except for the most magically gifted like Mozart, where it's important to really know how to work in a disciplined way at your craft. And In many cases, that natural gift makes it unnecessary for the really talented person to expend that much effort, whereas people who have less talent but more desire do learn how to really work at it in order to get good, and when they reach that transitional period, very often they'll surpass their more talented counterparts just because they've gotten better at working at their craft.
You know, I have a thought on that, which is really, I think that's really very to the point. You know, when I was younger, I was very gifted at this, and I remember my violin teacher actually reducing me to tears when he said, you know, a person who's gifted will get ahead quickly, but eventually everyone catches up, and then you don't have the necessary skills to actually do what's necessary to get to the next stage. And I think that's the heart of the problem of integration, is that what gets you good as a child imitator is never, as our two guests have said, the same kind of thing that gets you good as an adult, yet you've invested your whole ego and personality in that kind of success early on, and it simply requires a whole different reinvention to do the next stage.
Go ahead, Jean.
I totally agree. That's exactly what I was trying to say. Thank you, Rob.
Right. Yes.
But I would say that this just shows that children who are prodigies need to be challenged. They need to have teachers who really challenge them. They shouldn't be allowed to just
challenge
coast.
Them in that field, Ellen, or challenge them if they're a superb violinist to go and run around the block how far do you go with this?
What I think you're asking is, should we take a prodigy and try to make him well-rounded? Should we try to make this child more like a normal child? And parents worry about that, but first of all, I would say these kids are not normal and there's no way to make them normal. Of course, I would encourage
mean that in a bad way.
I don't mean it in a bad way at all. I mean they're not typical, and you can't make these kids typical. It's very difficult to take. I mean, Rob just told us that he played sports just as a way of getting his father to allow him to focus on music. It's hard to make a child do something that child really doesn't want to do. So you can't make these children into well-rounded kids.
I want to go back to the calls, but I want to go once quickly around the horn here on, again, just on definitions. When we talk about the child prodigy, are we talking about someone who is more than gifted, Rob? I mean, gifted is a word that's used now so much in the public school system. I'm in the gifted program in math.
Well, you know, one thing I will say, and it was brought up earlier. First of all, when you ask how do you know if someone's a prodigy, I think one of the questions or the answers that's standardly given is, if you have to ask, you're not. And I think that is often the case. But I do think that this point that was brought up early is really true, is that it is fundamentally an imitative skill that we, in a way, overvalue. I often call a lot of what these prodigies do, because I've conducted tons of Tchaikovsky concertos with these prodigies, is what I call a phonetic bar mitzvah. In other words, you know, it's learning the words, but you don't have the time to actually know what they mean, so you simply learn how to pronounce them. And they have, and this was pointed out by earlier guests, they have an incredible ability to imitate at a highly sophisticated level. It's what allows them to learn lots of languages, but essentially what they are is copying some teacher's interpretation, as Jean described it well, being told how to do something and sophisticatedly copying it. Chess matches are the same. You've learned enough games so that you've learned more than anyone else at your age, but it's an essentially imitative skill, which is fundamentally different from the next stage. So I think that the prodigies are often valued for an imitative, and in fact Mozart too. You talked about composing. His early pieces were amazing but not good. None of the pieces that he wrote as a kid were really good. It was simply his incredible ear to imitate whatever style was available. So they were not actually good pieces of music. And Gene, I think it's that getting beyond the imitative that's hard.
Gene, we're in a realm of beyond gifted, though. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, I suppose. Beyond gifted.
That we use the word gifted today, which just means above average to a lot of parents.
Well, I never have quite understood these distinctions. People talk about gifted and talented, and I don't know what they're talking about there either. But I think the critical thing is what happens after the child shows some phenomenal ability to get around on the instrument. And I think composing is a whole other thing, by the way.
Right.
But I think that when you hear a child being able to get around on the instrument in this phenomenal way, it's after that really counts. I mean, I just totally agree with Rob that it's... And I think what's involved in that is learning how to be reflective.
Right.
That is learning how to think about and not being scared to think about what you're doing.
And also the hard thing is you have to give up your whole identity. You know, so much of your identity as a child gets involved in being this enormous success that everyone focuses on for a particular skill, and all of a sudden that's not there anymore. That's no longer your defining ability, and that is an enormous death and resurrection experience to reinvent yourself as an adult in which that's not the case, in which not everyone is fawning over your ability to play the Tchaikovsky concerto because now other people can play it as well. And that reinvention is really hard. You know, I have a very just personal story, which is so striking this week, when I do a lot of pieces that involve child performers, pieces that I wrote. And when I first recorded Green Eggs and Ham about 10 years ago, the child star, Brett Tabasel, was the person on the recording. He was 12 years old. He was the star of the Broadway show Big, an amazing star. And then this week I just saw that Macaulay Culkin, another lost child star, was arrested for possession of drugs, and driving the car was Brett Tabasel.
Ellen, quickly, just parents use the word gifted now so much in terms of trying to figure out where their own children's talents lie. Do we take it off the table for a conversation about prodigies?
I would say that a prodigy is a child at the very extreme end of a continuum. And so a gifted child is just lower down on the continuum in terms of level of skill. But we do use the word gifted very loosely now. I mean, a child with a 120 IQ is admitted into a gifted program, slightly above average. So we're talking about kids who are very different from what we mean by typical gifted kids who are.
All right. To Cary, North Carolina, Elizabeth's with us on the phone from there. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I have a question. I am the parent of a child who I believe is remarkably gifted, and I'm not the only one who thinks so, but I've been hearing conflicting views over whether or not, and my question is it more important for a parent to allow the child and enable the child to really pursue their gifts and reach their potential, or is it the responsibility of the parent to try to allow or force the child to be as normal as possible, like in a regular classroom and things like that?
Jean, do you want to start off with Elizabeth on this?
Well, first question is, what kind of a gift has she got?
She is remarkably gifted with language and not speaking foreign languages, but reading, and her understanding of history and really philosophy is way beyond her.
How old is she now, Elizabeth?
She's 9.
Jean, back to you.
Yeah, well, I think the most dangerous or most sad thing that parents can do with kids is to isolate them, to set them apart, even if they are set apart in what they're able to do. I still think that it's I don't see why you can't do both. I mean, for example, she could be in a regular classroom and have outside stimulation from some local college students. That's what I did with my own kids. I used to bring students home from MIT to talk to my kids about science and to do experiments and things like that. But they were definitely a part of the group. And I think that was critical.
Is there a right answer to Elizabeth's question?
Well, I would also say, you know, once you use the word force, you know you're in trouble.
Yep.
I think once I even hear that word, I know you're in trouble. You know, also the other thing is, I don't think you can, back to what Ellen said, which is true, I don't think you can force someone to be a prodigy. If it's not naturally within them, kids won't learn it.
But you also can't force a prodigy to be normal. I think, I think this questioner is asking two questions. Is it her responsibility to force her child to be normal? And I think she can't do that, and she shouldn't do that. She's also asking, I think, the question of whether she should keep the child in a regular classroom. I think the most important thing to think about is whether your child is bored.
Right.
But I also agree with Jean that I think it's a big mistake to take these children and accelerate them radically and send them to college at extremely young ages.
Right.
I don't think you need to do that. You can find mentors and find ways of stimulating your child and not accelerate them radically. You might accelerate your child moderately, but many years, I think, is a mistake because you isolate the child.
Isn't it interesting, Jean, that we still haven't really kind of figured out exactly what is required in helping a prodigy?
And I think the other thing is the nature of these mentors. I mean, if you have a mentor, I mean, this child seems to be particularly into intellectual subjects, but even so, I think if you have a mentor who is challenging, as Ellen said before, and is asking the child to think beyond where he or she is, just beyond, finding a really wonderful teacher mentor is somebody, I think, who senses the edge of where the child is at and just can push them right over that little edge, and that's extremely exciting.
Jean, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today. It was nice to have you here.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Jean Bamberger is a retired professor of music at MIT, joining us there on the line from Berkeley, California. She's the author of such works as Growing Up Prodigies, The Midlife Crisis. That's part of what we're talking about on this hour. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Have we figured out what a prodigy is and what, as a parent, to do and how to help those children over that great big gap that separates childhood from adulthood? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Ellen Winner, professor of psychology at Boston College. Rob Capello, composer, conductor, is joining us from Rivervale, New Jersey. And we're talking about child prodigies. We'd like to include you in that conversation. And we're going to go straight to St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada. Robin's joining us. Hi, Robin.
Hello. I'm very nervous.
All right.
Extremely nervous.
Then you must not be a child prodigy.
No, I'm 38. Let me explain. Child prodigies are gifted. They are geniuses, little geniuses. And little geniuses have Asperger syndrome. Asperger syndrome is a form of autism. They're basically learning disabled. When a child is so gifted at that age, everybody pays attention to them. The world's their oyster, so to speak. And then when they have to reach adulthood, you know, they have to learn to live and live in the real world. And then they have mental illness, and that's what happens to these people. Then they have drug addictions and so on and so forth.
Have you seen any of this in your own family?
I'm autistic. I'm crazy. just yesterday, I finally got an official disability. I'm, like, right off the map.
What's your skill, Robin?
Well, that's hard to explain because it's a lot of things. As a child, I could do math. Like, I really made... There was a doctor's son in class. He used to study like crazy. His parents put all the effort and time into him, and I know he was prepared for everything all the time. And yet at math, I never studied anything, and I was the class troublemaker, and yet I could look at something and get it as fast as him or faster, and it used to drive him crazy. And then I started writing. But once I hit adulthood, everything really went wrong. But I just want to say it's Asperger's syndrome.
Is it, well, hang on just a sec, Robin. I want to turn to Ellen here. Is it Asperger's? Is it always some kind of imbalance or you know, however you want to describe it?
Well, I think that this caller is raising a very interesting question, is bringing up a very interesting issue, and that is that we often do see child prodigies who have serious disabilities. And you do find what we call savants, autistic savants, who have Asperger syndrome, who have all kinds of problems, but who have an extreme gift. And you find savants in the area of calculation, mm-hmm. Drawing very realistically, and music performing, typically. I think what's interesting about these children is that they are like prodigies, but they don't grow into adult creators because they don't transform a domain. They don't do something radically new, but they are like child prodigies in many ways. They're incredibly good at mastering a domain that's already out there. What's different about them from child prodigies is that this is their island of high ability, and they have serious disabilities along with that.
And also, in a way, it's a kind of a continuum. That may be the most extreme version, but even the other ones are trying hard not to be that. In other words, to not have the ability to master one tiny domain be the entire sum of your life.
Robin, let me ask you if there is, if you look back at this really bumpy transition that you describe from being the highly skilled child to the uncomfortable adult, is there anything that you would have, could have done differently?
Somebody should have noticed. Nobody actually noticed. That was my problem. They just labeled me as bad. I wasn't actually picked up because I never focused on one thing. To focus on something is an obsession. For a child prodigy, whether I was artistic, I could draw like realistically. I could do math. I could do almost anything. But I was like ADHD, as they say. I was hyperactive. I couldn't settle down for 25 seconds in class. I couldn't do anything. I was good in sports. I was good at everything. I annoyed people.
But what difference would it have made, Robin, if someone had? You know, taken a good, long, hard look at you at age 11 and said, ha, we know this now.
It would have helped a lot to understand myself. I've been spending my entire life trying to understand why I was different. I knew I was different at age 7, and I've been spending the entire time. Right now I have a 2-year-old son. He is amazing. He's brilliant. And I understand him, and that I think just understanding the way he is. I know he has Asperger's. I've read up on it, and he walks around on his tippy toes like a little ballerina. He's two. He knows all his ABCs backwards, forwards. He can count to 20. He's brilliant. And I know that, and what I'm going to do is just not... Children are born perfect and beautiful. All you have to do is not screw it up. People screwed me up. So what I'm going to do is not screw him up.
Robin, I think...
Bottle that.
I thank you for your call. It was nice to have you on the program. Rob, did you want to add anything?
No, I think that was good. I mean, I do think it is a challenge. There's no doubt about it. You know, we do have a kind of fixed idea of what's normal. And I think, as many of our guests have pointed out, and Alan as well, is that these kids are not normal. And how to respond to something not normal isn't written in a book. There's no easy way to be a parent to someone who's that gifted. But I do think that what Robin is saying is right, too. You have to be in touch with it moment by moment. And there's that delicate balance of what does a kid need to push them forward, but what's pushing them more forward than they want to be. And I think you do have to throw the rule book out when you're dealing with kids like this to figure out what makes the right course. But being in there, as he was saying, with them along the way and trying to find out from their point of view of what's the next good thing as opposed to what just, you know, works well for the media is a tough one, and there's no good rule book.
I think Robin is describing a very atypical kind of case. Usually we hear about savants who are obsessed in one particular area. Stephen Wiltshire, the savant in drawing, for instance, or calculating savants. Robin seems to have had savant skills in a wide arena, a wide variety of areas, and also no adult picked up on it and nurtured it. Stephen Wiltshire has been nurtured. He's published several books of his drawings. He's been written about by Oliver Sacks, and I'm sure that it helps to have his talent recognized.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Columbia, South Carolina. David's with us. Hello, David.
How you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question is, has there been any instances throughout history where you've had a prodigy, a child prodigy, develop into like a politician or into a military leader or something in the religious sector? Is there any instances of that happening? Instead of just a particular skill, say like a violinist or a mathematician, but something more on a social level.
No, it's a great question.
That's a wonderful question. And, you know, we don't recognize prodigies in those domains.
Right.
We don't recognize these are domains that aren't really accessible to children, being a politician, being a lawyer, for instance. We don't see child lawyer prodigies. That doesn't mean that these children weren't the people who become great leaders or great religious leaders, great political leaders, were probably, in my guess, unusual as children.
So does that mean that it's possible, if we went back and looked at the childhood of presidents or corporate leaders or the kind of people who have to have a lot of drive to succeed, that we might, in fact, find that they'd been particularly gifted at playing the clarinet at age four?
Yeah, it's a good point. You know, the thing is, the skill is not as codifiable and noticeable.
Right.
You know, in other words, what it takes to be a great leader requires an integration of several skills, no single one of which can easily be judged, like playing the violin or something like that. So it might turn out, retrospectively, that other skills that don't look like, call it politician, when you're 12, are connected, but we don't have an easily codifiable thing that looks like a lawyer at 12 the way we do a violinist.
Right. I mean, politicians might have had very good social skills as children. They might have been very good at figuring out who knew who and who liked who and who didn't like who, and they have a very good social map of their second grade classroom. But we don't know what to look for.
Right.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Boston. Eric's with us. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling. What are you thinking?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm on the street, so there may be a little background noise. I was a dancer with American Ballet Theater and Boston Ballet. I would not assume that I was a protege. I would go in that gifted category.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just have a couple reflections. I'm fortunate that my parents encouraged my interest and my talents. At the same time, I'm glad that I didn't have what's known as a stage mother, where my success became more important to my parents than to me. So I think parents of gifted or kids that are prodigies have a really tricky line to walk there. And I know in my own profession, somebody mentioned before, I think, was it a coach saying that some of the kids that aren't as talented but really apply themselves actually do better than the prodigies? You see a lot of that.
And do those kids then go on to become better ballet dancers in their 20s if they've learned that kind of work ethic when they're 12?
Exactly. See, I wasn't a protege because I was not dancing principal roles when I was 18, but when I was in my 20s, I was. And there are, you know, other dancers that come to mind where I know, wow, you know, they were, you know, they had a good dose of talent, but it was really their hard work that led to their success. And what happened with me in the profession, when I was about 25, I realized, well, you know, I'm good, I can make a living, but it's the type of profession where if you're not a star, it gets to be a little bit of a really hard way to make a living after a while. You know, Boston Ballet, I was doing 52 Nutcrackers a year, 7 parts, 2 or 3 parts each show. So I know that's one dilemma that comes up for people, and a lot of dancers, you know, when they're 25 or 26, they'll go back to school, or if they're lucky, marry rich. So when I hear people say, oh, you know, you were a dancer, gee, I wish I was a dancer, but I didn't have the feet, or I was a dancer, but I wanted to be a dancer, but was too fat or too short, I'd say, you know, trust me, you were better off. So it's an interesting thing when you're, you know, above average talent, but not a protege. I can think of one protege that I was in school with in New York City. I was at the School of American Ballet, which is the New York City Ballet School, but for my academics, I went to professional children's school. And a young girl who was in my, a couple years younger than me at the school that I was seeing in the library was Midori, the
violinist. Midori was certainly a prodigy.
Yeah.
She also
has made a transition into adulthood, I would say. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, she's still performing. I think it's, and probably will go on to perform, and, you know, the future, we don't know the future, but she's certainly continuing to perform at a very high level. I think what you're suggesting is prodigies who don't work very hard aren't going to make it, because if they think they can just slide by easily because they have the skills and they don't get disciplined, they're not going to make it. But I think to suggest that really hard work is more important than innate talent is a mistake. I think hard work is absolutely necessary, but it's not sufficient.
Yeah, also I think that, you know, there's so many people with an enormous amount of talent that working hard can make a big difference. But I think the thing he said, which was most poignant to me and I think is really crucial, is he said he tells people that they're lucky that they didn't go on and do it. And I think in a way that goes to the heart and the crux of all of this, which is that being good at something when you're young, a particular skill which gives you enormous ego rewards and a sense of self, is a very different thing than having the kind of curiosity and love for something that's going to sustain you for a lifetime. And I think that, you know, there's a big difference between, as Alan and Jean have pointed out, between loving music and playing the piano well.
But I don't know how you tell the difference. It may sound like a silly question, but if you are so skilled at something that every time you sit down at the piano bench, and say you're 7 or 8 years old, everyone, you know, in the house or in the neighborhood sits down and says, oh, Rob's going to play.
Right.
How do you know the difference between that as a skill that you happen to have and that as a passion that you may happen to have?
Well, I think, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, I can just only use my own kid as a perfect example since it's just happening right now. You know, I have 3 kids, and we had all of them play instruments. It was just a rule in the house. You had to play for 5 years. Not any big pushing. No one was going to be a star in any way. They all went to my concerts, and I compose all day. But we just had them play, and they all played. None of them were very serious. All of a sudden, out of the blue, this year my son started composing. I never asked him to, I never tried to, and all of a sudden now he's spending 5 hours a day composing and wants theory and composition lessons. Something clicked in his head that had absolutely nothing to do with me.
Except your genes.
He got interested in it.
You passed on your genes to him.
Well, maybe that's what it is, but what I'm saying is a year ago, I could have forced him, tried, there would have been absolutely no response.
Right.
And at a certain point, he became curious and, just like Ellen was saying, became self-motivated and decided to drive himself. But it had nothing to do with anything that I forced him. And in a moment, it became interesting, what was not interesting before. And so I think that kind of curiosity is immediately, you know, apparent. And when you work with these kids, you can really see the ones who are just fundamentally curious about music and how it works. That's not necessarily the same ones who are the best imitators.
It's like the kids who go off and read math books versus just score high on their SATs.
Right. And that's, as a parent, I think the most important thing is to get your kids to be curious, because even though you may have mastered a skill that gets you rewards at 12, it's that kind of lifelong curiosity that's going to make a life of it worthwhile.
Let's go back to our callers, to Sudbury, and Ellen's joining us on the line. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question going back to the discussion of Asperger's and more savant-type children. Would you recommend a lot of those kinds of children, and even some gift, some prodigies, have social skills, weaknesses in the social skills area? And I was wondering what Ellen thought of the idea of teaching children like that social skills. And I'm thinking of Nathaniel Hawthorne's book called The Birthmark, where an alchemist tried to remove the imperfections of his wife, of her birthmark, and she became basically nothing. And I was wondering what you thought of teaching social skills or teaching more self-awareness to children.
Yeah. I think what you're asking is, if I teach my child social skills, will the gift disappear?
Right.
And I don't think we have any evidence for that. You know, there was a savant named Nadia, who was a drawing savant, and she didn't, she was severely autistic. And when she was discovered and given language therapy and taught some language, she stopped drawing. And people drew the conclusion that I think was faulty, that by teaching her language, it caused her gift to go away. Some savant skills just stop. We don't know why. But there's no evidence that teaching your child social skills is going to cause the gift to go away. And by all means, I think it's important to do. It will help your child.
And if we're talking about that skill to imitate, which we began the program by talking about, Ellen, are you saying that that's not a very useful thing, or that in fact it is or can be a very useful thing for these kids?
I don't think that we should disparage prodigies by saying they're just imitators. I don't think there's anything else they can be. There's no way to go on to become a major creator in a field until you've mastered it. And one of the ways you master a field is by imitating what's already been done. So it's completely to be expected that prodigies are going to be imitators. But it does help us understand why so few can make the transition between being a prodigy and being what I call a big C creator.
And even in fact, all of us grow up learning by imitation. You know, in a way, it's what connects us to the prodigies, though they're a more extreme version. We all grow up in the midst of a sea of influences about how to be an adult, how to be social, how to be everything. And then in the end, though you start by imitating, at some point you have to become the author of your own life and take what you've imitated and turn it into your own. So in a way, everyone faces that same problem, only the prodigies face it in a more extreme form.
Because we have such expectations for prodigies. We expect that if they're a prodigy, they're going to become a great adult genius. And I think that's a very unfair expectation.
And in fact, when they become just normally successful adults, somehow that's a down.
Right. We think they're failures.
Right.
And
exactly.
I think that's very unfair.
And they themselves feel that way.
Right.
Better to allow them to become normal children, small c creators at a child's age. That seems to be something that parents can encourage. We're out of time for the program, but lots to think about. I want to thank Rob. Thanks for being with us. Nice to hear from you.
My pleasure.
Rob Capello, conductor and composer. Ellen Winner, it was nice to have you in the program. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Ellen is a professor of psychology at Boston College, author of Gifted Children, Myths and Realities. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Matt Lieber, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Help from Addie Goss and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.